You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 7th of December 2018 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Live from Midori House in London, this is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up, France boards up and battens down ahead of further demonstrations. But haven't the protesters got what they want? Also ahead, US President Donald Trump unveils some new hires and makes some candid remarks about one previous one. We'll see if we can figure out what Greece's Prime Minister and Russia's President have to discuss. We'll find out why a landmark New York bookstore does not wish to be called a landmark New York bookstore and...
I'm very much a writer also, so I'm kind of announcing to myself what I'm about to become. I was thinking of Chris as a character. I was starting to allow myself to become that character. Sometimes it raises questions about sincerity and honesty and like, where does the character stop and the real human begins? And I'm like, this is so intricate even for me.
We'll hear from Christine and the Queens, all that, plus our weekly global countdown and more besides. That's coming up on the Monocle Daily live from London starting now. And welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily with me, Andrew Muller. Once again, Paris is in the brace position.
Nous avons en face de nous des gens qui ne sont pas là pour manifester, mais qui sont là pour casser. Et nous voulons faire en sorte de ne pas leur laisser les mains libres. Nous avons mobilisé un nombre considérable de forces de l'ordre. 8000 à Paris, c'est beaucoup plus encore que samedi dernier. Et au total, sur l'ensemble de la France...
That was Prime Minister Edouard Philippe angrily anticipating another round of mayhem as further massive protests are planned in Paris and other French cities. Hundreds of thousands of people have taken to the streets in recent weeks in demonstrations impressive even when adjusted for France's traditional enthusiasm for such outings. The protests, distinguished by and named for the yellow vests worn by many participants, started as a complaint about fuel taxes, since rescinded, but now appear to have reached the "what have you got" stage of rebellion. Well, I'm joined now by Eliane Pelletier, a reporter at the Paris Bureau of the New York Times, and by the political commentator Agnès Poirier. Eliane, first of all, what does Paris feel like tonight, bit after 11 p.m. on a Friday night?
Well, Paris really feels like it was already in a lockdown. The Champs-Élysées, where the shops on the Champs-Élysées were completely shuttered. The subway was kind of pretty empty in the western parts of Paris, and tomorrow is going to be the same. The Eiffel Tower is going to be closed. The Louvre Museum is going to be closed, as other museums. So I feel like everyone was just bracing for what's going to happen tomorrow.
That quote we heard from the Prime Minister, Edouard Philippe, in French, obviously, to translate it partially, was talking about 8,000 extra police in Paris, 89,000 in France overall. Apart from those shops and other attractions being closed, what other measures are being taken? I understand that football matches are being postponed as well.
Right. Six Ligue 1 games have been postponed throughout the country, including... the PSG game in Paris. I think we should pause a moment on those numbers of police forces. 8,000 police officers in Paris is massive. The security forces were already really, really present last weekend, and there were 4,600. So that's going to be almost as twice as much tomorrow. So the situation is going to be really, really tense. That's the least we can say. We're also going to see 12 armored vehicles. They are not vehicles of the military. They're vehicles from the gendarmerie, so some sorts of riot police. We don't know how they're going to be deployed. We don't know where they're going to be deployed and how they're going to be used. But those images of those vehicles have really scared people, because it's going to be the first time in 50 years that those vehicles are going to be used in Paris itself.
I'll bring you now in, Agnès. As I was saying in the introduction, the fuel taxes, which appeared to have prompted these demonstrations in the first instance, have now been rowed back on. So if this is no longer about fuel taxes, what is it about?
Well, it's about so many things. I think we could go back to 30 years of French public policies, and actually Macron has only been in power for 18 months. That's the irony. It's much bigger than Macron, even though Macron's personality might have been a trigger in their whole protest. Look, there's no one profile of the yellow vest. They come from different walks of life, socially, professionally, very different backgrounds. They usually belong to the rural, more provincial and rural France. But apart from that, they also belong to different political families. Recently, the French daily newspaper Le Monde compiled the first 50 or the most common demands of the very different yellow vests, 50 of them. And they compared them to the political programs of the different French political families and French politicians, and looked as if it did correspond to two politicians. One is Marine Le Pen, the extreme right leader, and the second was the extreme left leader, Jean-Luc Mélenchon. They ask, for instance, things like leaving the European Union, leaving NATO, less taxes and yet more public services. But it's only four of the very varied demands. Some of them are very practical, some others are quite grandiose. They want a new constitution. They want the destitution of the French president who was democratically elected only 18 months ago. So it's very difficult to actually pin them down to, you know, one streak of politics. Hence the uncertainty, hence the instability, hence the danger. And the danger also comes from the fact that they are still without an organization behind them. I mean, in terms of what I mean is that they haven't organized themselves or structured themselves. Therefore, it's very difficult for the French government, for instance, to actually meet representatives. They tried a week ago to come up with representatives, but straight away, the eight representatives they had come up with were straight away disqualified by some fringes of the protest. So it makes it a very difficult protest even to debate with.
All that being the case, Agnes, was it therefore a strategic mistake to concede on the fuel taxes? Because does that leave President Macron with anything else he can do?
Well, you know, there are other things he can do, and actually, that's not the only measures that, you know, was announced by the French Prime Minister this week. There is going to be also electricity and gas prices usually increase on the 1st of January, and this has also been suspended for 2019. And perhaps more importantly, what we call consultation, that is to say, coming to the table with social partners in France, trade unions, etc., professional representatives, to come on the table and to start talking. One note of optimism, for instance, for this weekend is that town halls throughout France are opening their doors this weekend so that citizens and yellow vests can come in and write down or just express their anger and perhaps say what they would hope for. So that's the beginning of a discussion, if you'd like. Perhaps we need to go through the fourth act. That's how they call this fourth Saturday of unrest tomorrow. And perhaps, like in all tragedies, and I hope it's not too much of a tragedy, we can come to a resolution. But as long as violence obliterate national discourse, we cannot hear reason or even start talking to each other.
Eliane, the demonstrations have been very, very large, but they have, of course, not involved the overwhelming majority of French people. Is it possible to see, looking away from the protests, which way public sympathy is trending?
Well, first of all, they have been large, but if you compare them to previous protests in France, and we all know that, you know, French are used to protest, they were not that large, and they've been dwindled, you know, weekends after weekends, the numbers have decreased. However, it's really interesting to see that, according to different polls, In between 65 and 75% of the French do support the movement. Now it remains to be seen whether more scenes of violence are going to eat up that that support. But for now, it's here to stay, and the Yellow Vests feel entitled to keep protesting because they do believe that the French are behind them, for sure.
And just finally, Eliane, is there a sense yet that whether or not this has legs as a movement, whether it might develop into something that becomes a permanent part of French political discourse, or is everyone going to go home when it gets cold?
Well, I think, you know, what Agnès was mentioning, the town halls opening their doors, I think it's a really interesting thing to follow and to explore, because that movement started on social media, on Facebook. People started to organize on Facebook groups and said they were interested and they would participate in Facebook events. Then they met on roundabouts and they met on toolboard. Then they went to the streets and some of them went to Paris, and that's when it turned violent. And now the government has tried to open a small door, but still a door for dialogue by, you know, encouraging mayors and local representatives to open their doors and collect the local anger throughout France. So it's moving, you know. Many Yellow Vest representatives are also calling for more dialogue now. They don't want to be associated with those images of violence that we've seen. They want to talk, they want to negotiate, they want to be heard. And they want Mr. Macron to hear that anger. They want to meet him, which has not happened yet. So it's really hard to say whether it's going to be part of France, because you always need faces, you need spokespersons, you need representatives for that. And as Agnès was pointing out, it's been really hard to single out people. We've seen, you know, some well-known faces, but a lot of them are controversial, have been discredited by other Yellow Vests. If they manage to do have really representative and popular spokespersons, then, you know, we might expect them to be part of, you know, not the political landscape for sure, but at least not for now, but definitely part of the public discussion. At least the media, the French media, have been eager to give them a voice and to hear them, mostly because they were startled at that movement. We were all intrigued, and so we didn't know who we could interview, because they're everywhere. You know, I mean, it's everyone can just like wear a yellow vest and say, you know, that they're angry. So if they manage to get real messengers, as they say, and more than representatives, then maybe it's going to have a more permanent footprint in the French landscape for sure.
Eliane Pelletier, Agnès Poirier, thank you for joining us. You're listening to Monocle 24. This is the Monocle Daily Live from Studio One at Midori House in London. US President Donald Trump is having quite the day, of which more shortly, but he has been hiring today as well. One of his choices, in fairness, is not obviously insane. William Barr, who Trump has nominated as Attorney General, can boast the self-evident qualification of having previously been Attorney General during the presidency of the late George H.W. Bush. Trump's pick as new US ambassador to the UN, however, is rather more Trumpian. To follow in the footsteps of such distinguished diplomats as Henry Cabot Lodge, Adlai Stevenson, George H.W. Bush, Madeleine Albright and Richard Holbrooke, he's picked Heather Nauert off Fox News. Well, I'm joined with more by Dr. Jeannie Zeno, Professor of Political Science at Iona College in New York. Jeannie, first of all, we should talk about the news which has broken in the last few minutes while we've been on air, which is that prosecutors have requested a substantial jail term, believed to be 4 to 6 years, for Trump's ex-lawyer Michael Cohen. They have released the deep results of their investigations into Cohen. How bad does this look for the president?
I think it's pretty shocking for all of us. Michael Cohen's attorneys had recently requested leniency because he has been cooperative. And of course, just recently, the prosecutors had given Michael Flynn, another advisor to the president, asking for no jail time for Michael Flynn, who is facing one count. And of course, we just learned, as you said, that they are asking for at least 4 to 6 years for Michael Cohen, which is a very, very tough and substantial prison sentence for Michael Cohen, the president's former, quote, fixer or his lawyer. So it is, you know, a very difficult night, certainly for Cohen and his family, but it bodes very badly for the president because it suggests that Michael Cohen, his fixer, that some of the material that they pulled from his office in that famous raid some time ago may have been very substantial and helpful in terms of getting closer to Trump and his family.
None of it looks good for anybody involved. It looks especially bad when the prosecutors are saying that Cohen committed campaign finance crimes in coordination with and at the direction of this person known as Individual One. Or they do say elsewhere in the report that Individual One ran for president and won, which does rather tip the wink as to who they're talking about.
You think you know who they're talking about, do you, Andrew? Yeah. Not so disguised there. It bodes very badly for the president. I mean, right there in that one example you gave, he's being implicated in campaign finance, certainly crime. And again, you know, we don't know whether they'd be able to prove that or not. But certainly they are saying that Michael Cohen engaged in this crime, but he did so at the direction of this candidate who has then become president of the United States. And so it does suggest that Mueller is tightening the noose, as they say, around Trump and around Trump's inner circle and certainly around Trump's family. And there's nobody who has been closer to Trump besides his children in all these years than Michael Cohen. So from that perspective, to see that they are going for a 4 to 6 year, the best sentence that the prosecutors could get, the most substantial, suggests that they have an awful lot up their sleeve in terms of Michael Cohen and the president.
With all due acknowledgement that we do now live in a world, or at least the presidential news cycle lives in a world in which it completely revolves every 15 minutes, we should discuss these two appointments which have been announced today. Heather Nauert, first of all, as the US ambassador to the United Nations, is she quite as odd an appointment as she appears?
In the Trump era, she's not, you know, as odd as she would be normally. Heather Nauert, who I know personally, is a very smart woman. She has been a reporter and she has been an anchor mostly, although not exclusively, on Fox News for many years before she became the highest ranking woman in the State Department. She has been very close to Donald Trump and his daughter and his son-in-law, Ivanka and Jared. And of course, since we have gotten the new Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, she has been very close to him. She previously worked under Rex Tillerson, and they famously were not particularly close. That said, she is an odd pick to the extent that she has, you know, the people you mentioned at the top, Henry Cabot Lodge, George H.W. Bush, Jean Kirkpatrick. These are people who all come with a substantial amount of foreign policy experience, you know, and this is, you know, Heather Nauert does not come with that. She comes with a background in reporting, and she didn't even spend that much time reporting overseas. Most of her time was spent domestically. So she has been in the State Department for a while as a spokesperson. She has traveled a bit with the new Secretary of State. But yes, to your point, it is a out of the box, if we can say, appointment. And of course, she is going to face a very tough Senate confirmation. She's likely not going to get confirmed immediately by Democrats in the Senate, who are going to have a very difficult time understanding how she could, you know, represent the United States, so many issues at play in the UN, how she could, without the background that other other UN ambassadors have brought to it, really represent the United States. And we should say that, you know, Nikki Haley also faced some really big challenges in that respect. She was a governor. She was an elected public official. She had no foreign policy experience. With Heather Nauert, we have somebody with no political experience, no elected official experience, and no foreign policy background, except for this 1 year as a spokesperson in the State Department. So it's an odd choice by all accounts, but in the Trump era, it's in keeping with what we've seen.
Okay, we should talk very briefly as well about the other nominee he's announced today. This is William Barr, previous Attorney General, now about to become Attorney General again. There does seem to be kind of a pattern with some of Trump's more legal appointments, this and his nominees to the Supreme Court, that he does get a bit orthodox Republican at moments like this. This is not a controversial choice, is it?
It's not. I mean, William Barr, as you said, served as Attorney General from 1991 to 1993 under the first Bush administration. He's a well-respected establishment Republican. And to your point, I think that's what we've seen in some of these Supreme Court appointments and considerations, and also in this appointment. He is somebody who comes with a good amount of respect and a good amount of experience. He's also somebody who famously really does see a role for a very strong executive and supports executive power. And so that's something that the president certainly is going to be attracted to. But to your point, he is somebody who's not particularly controversial in Republican circles. Certainly, he's not going to be welcomed by the Democrats, but he certainly does have the expertise, the experience, and the respect. And I think for people who are very nervous about the interim appointment the president had made to this position, this is a much more solid and substantial appointment that is likely going to get through, and Republicans are going to breathe a sigh of relief that it is somebody that they can get behind. And we've already seen Senator John Cornyn of Texas say that Republicans would secure the votes they need fairly easily to confirm Barr.
Jeannie Zeno, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to The Daily.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Weighing in at almost 400 pages, the Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes is packed with everything you need to know about making a great place to live. The book is filled with handsome residences and all the contacts you need to make a home that will last a lifetime. And it's a book that celebrates the people who know homes should be able to cope with kids, dogs, and a few scuff marks too. It's a book that knows a home is only as good as the community it's in, and it's a book that takes you through the front doors of everything from mountain hideaways to modernist towers. So be cozy and buy your copy today at monocle.com.
You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. When Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras travelled to Moscow to meet Russian President Vladimir Putin in 2015, it was seen by some as reason to fear Moscow getting its hooks into a Western democracy, which was also a member of NATO. It may be that the thing we should have been worried about was underestimating Russia's ambitions in this respect. Today, however, Tsipras has been repeating the trip. It's the first meeting between the pair since Greece stood up to Russia back in July, bouncing to Russian diplomats and refusing admission to two others who Greece accused of stirring up trouble while efforts were made to resolve the disagreement over the name of neighbouring Macedonia. I'm joined with more by Anthi Karasava, a freelance reporter in Athens working for Sky News and CBC. Was there a particular reason for this trip? Has this been long scheduled, or was it a sudden friendly impulse?
No, it was long scheduled, and it was a very, very important visit for Alexis Tsipras, and it was clear from the body language and statements he made at a joint press conference with Vladimir Putin that he was extremely keen, in fact, much more keen than the Russian president to bury the hatchet and effectively reboot relations between Greece and Russia. He spoke of a so-called rainy day in very warm relations between Greece and Russia. That's how he called this spy fiasco, this imbroglio. And he said that Greece, in fact, wanted to pursue these close ties with Russia again. Mr. Putin, however, on the other hand, was much more frigid. He stood on his ground. He stood his ground, refusing yet again to accept any allegations, implications in spying, calling them rubbish and nonsense. But at the same time, he too said that this was a chapter that had closed in Greek-Russian relations.
How is Russia generally perceived in Greece? Is it seen as quite the menace that it seems to be seen as the in Western Europe in particular?
Absolutely not. Greece and Russia have had long-standing, traditional, friendly ties. There's almost a relation, the religious relation, that there's a common religion that both countries share. And this particular government of Alexis Tsipras had very, very close ties in the start of his term in 2015, to the point that it had aggravated and concerned the West quite a bit. It stood up against the West, Tsipras, on several occasions, even with the latest spy affair in the UK, blocking sanctions against Russia, and Greece, of course, being one of the few countries in the West that did not call back its diplomats and did not sever diplomatic ties in the light of frosty relations between Moscow and the UK. So Tsipras is trying to reboot these relations. He's coming to an end of his term, so he wants to be sure that on his way out, he has reestablished these very important ties between the two countries.
Does he think, though, that it's important to Greece and certainly important to him to be seen to be standing up to Russia? Because following on from this spat with the diplomats, he has, of course, said today to Putin that he's not happy about Russia selling the S-400 missile systems to Turkey, which it's hard to imagine Russia being terribly interested what Greece thinks in this about this, rather, isn't it?
You're absolutely right on this. And there's no doubt that despite this talk of rebooting relations and overcoming this rift, there's still substantive differences that remain on the background, in the background, and that there are problems in this relations. And that perhaps this spy spat has created an even larger and a more serious rift than we're seeing. Greece, the issue of Macedonia, for example, in the Balkans, remains a very thorny issue. Greece has now accepted and supports Macedonia's accession to NATO and the EU, something which Russia wants to scupper, wants to block. And it remains to be seen, of course, how it will continue its so-called influence campaign in the Balkans to try and block this endeavor to block Macedonia's entry to NATO. There's also the issue of Turkey. Tsipras, as you said, he's understood to have raised this case of Turkey purchasing this defense system from Russia. And Turkey, of course, plans to take delivery of this system next year. Of course, and Turkey will be the first NATO member state to do so. So there is a lot of concern on that front as well. So there are several issues that remain outstanding.
Anthi Karasava in Athens, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Daily. Here are some of the other stories we're following today. A Canadian court has been told that Mengwan Zhao, chief financial officer of Chinese telecoms giant Huawei, is wanted in the US on fraud charges relating to the breaking of sanctions on Iran. Ms. Wan Zhao, also daughter of Huawei's founder, was arrested at Vancouver Airport on Saturday. The US is seeking her extradition. China has demanded her release. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has emphasized that it is not his government's decision, though it remains to be seen how impressed Beijing will be by his homilies on the separation of the executive and the judiciary. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has stepped down as party leader of the Christian Democratic Union, which she has led for 18 years. Merkel will be succeeded as party leader by her preferred choice, Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, though Merkel intends to complete her current term as Chancellor due to run until 2021. Ms. Kramp-Karrenbauer, 56, also known as AKK, is the former Prime Minister of the state of Saarland. And China has launched the first ever mission to land a robotic craft on the dark side of the moon.
The Chang'e 4 mission departed the Xichang Satellite Launch Center atop a Long March 3B rocket, and all being well, will touch down in the von Karman crater early next month. Among other experiments, the Chang'e lander will carry potato and mustard seeds, which it will attempt to grow in a miniature biosphere. This is the Monocle Daily. This is The Daily with me, Andrew Muller. Bibliophilic listeners who have ever visited New York City will be familiar with The Strand, the labyrinthine family-owned bookshop on the corner of Broadway and 12th Street, which advertises itself, not inaccurately, as 18 miles of books. The shop is, if you will, a landmark, although it is presently resisting an official attempt to classify it as such. Well, I'm joined now by Henry Rhys Sheridan, Monocle reporter in New York. Henry, for those who have never had the considerable pleasure of The Strand, first of all, can you give us an idea of what it's like? It does rather need to be seen to be believed, doesn't it?
Yeah, so I visited The Strand for the first time after arriving in New York about 2 months ago. And it is, as the tagline attests, 18 miles of books. It is a vast labyrinthine complex of literary delights. But I think one thing for the purposes of this discussion that it's important to point out is that it isn't just a kind of fusty, romantic kind of library clone. You know, it's a very active centre of commerce. And on the ground floor in particular, you have all the sorts of literary bits and bobs, kind of novelties, notebooks that we've become used to seeing offered by bookstores. It's a live, active, buzzing literary hub in the heart of New York, and it's found its way into the hearts and imaginations and minds of not only New Yorkers, but also people all over the world who come to see it.
Well, it is, by your description, something that meets pretty much every definition of a landmark, and New York's Landmarks Preservation Commission appear to agree. We'll deal with that first. What do the Landmark Preservation Committee actually want to do?
So the Landmark Preservation Committee essentially wants to confer an official landmark status on the building. The main kind of effect of that is that it would protect the building, but in protecting it, it would also constrain what can be done to the building by its owners and operators. So they would have to check with the Landmark Committee before they make any adjustments to the building, any further developments to it. And it's precisely this that the owner of the store, Nancy Bass Wyden, takes objection to. Basically, she doesn't want this honour bestowed on her and her business, precisely because she thinks that she will be constrained in operating it by the somewhat onerous restraints that the status does confer or would confer on her. So, you know, she wouldn't be able to make any physical amendments to the building in particular without checking with these guys first. And, you know, making physical amendments to the building has really been in the lifeblood of the growth of the business ever since it was taken over by Nancy's father, Fred Bass, who sadly died earlier this year, not before establishing himself as an absolutely legendary figure on the New York bookselling scene. He moved the business that was started by his father to its current building, the place they want to make a landmark, and basically slowly took it over and turned it into the book lover's paradise that we see today. You know, and it's been at its very heart not only a kind of literary kind of oasis, but very much a thriving business since he took it over. She wants to keep it thriving, and to do that, she thinks she needs to be able to make any physical adjustment to the business that she needs to.
So as The Strand sees it, is it that ability to adapt, if necessary, even its physical surroundings that has kept it in business when so many other New York bookstores have gone out of business?
Precisely, yeah. I mean, they're really canny business owners, the Bass family, and they've done much more than simply selling books over the years. So they were one of the only independent bookstores of the cohort that they survived from that kind of leaned into selling things other than books that I've mentioned. They capitalized on their kind of street cred by flogging merchandise, T-shirts, tote bags that you see people walking around with, which now account for a really significant part of their revenue, about 15%. And they've got other kind of side hustles too. So you can rent their rare book room if you want like a literary themed wedding or other celebration as an event space. My favorite side hustle of theirs is that Nancy Bass Wyden herself kind of freelances as a kind of bookshelf dresser for the great and good of New York and further afield. So she uses her access to the Strand's stock in antique books to create literary backdrops for film and TV, also retail stores. And she also lends her services to celebrities and kind of curates their bookshelves to reflect the precise level of gravitas they desire. So she's worked with Tom Cruise, she's worked with Richard Gere. Apparently, and Andrew, I don't want you to get too excited here, she's worked with Bono. To preempt your next question, I could not find details on Bono's specific literary demands. But I say this to illustrate the fact that this plea from Nancy, the owner, for the Strand building not to be designated a landmark is really coming from the perspective of a commercial operator, not an anachronistic institution in need of a bailout or preservation.
Henry Rhys Sheridan in New York, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Monocle Daily. Do stay tuned.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
You're listening to The Daily with me, Andrew Muller. It's time now to take a look at the Asian and indeed Australasian newspapers. We're joined once again by Lloyd Burr, Europe correspondent for News Hub. Lloyd, we start with a story which News Hub is reporting, and indeed I'm sure all New Zealand media is reporting assiduously. This is the story of missing British tourist Grace Mullane, who has vanished from a hotel in Auckland. This is going to be a big deal in New Zealand, isn't it?
It is. Any time that there is a missing tourist, it doesn't happen that often, but there have been some cases of missing tourists over the past decades that have been quite horrible. So whenever we have a missing tourist, it is huge news in New Zealand, and it is dominating the news over there. It's even making the papers in Australia, which is no easy feat. And over here as well, you'll be seeing ITV, BBC as well. So it is a big story, and it's a very, very sad story that she's just disappeared the night before her 22nd birthday, and police are scouring all the CCTV footage all of around Central Auckland. At the moment, the last bit of CCTV footage that they have of her is going into a Central Auckland hotel called City Life Hotel with another man, and they've talked to the man about it. He's not in custody, but he's still a man of interest, and yet they're still just scouring through CCTV footage. Earlier that night, she was at Sky City Casino as well, and that was those two images of her was the last they've seen of her. So police say that they have grave concerns for her safety, but there's no evidence of foul play just yet. Despite that, though, her father, David, has flown over to Auckland from Essex and to be there and sort of try and track her down too.
I mean, a story like this at least should be a big story wherever it happens in the world and to whomever it happens to. But in New Zealand, does this become bigger than it otherwise might because this doesn't happen very often in a extremely safe and well-ordered country? Or is there a certain amount of nervousness about what the rest of the world might be perceiving about New Zealand?
It's probably both, actually. It's probably both. And they're probably both intertwined because New Zealand is such a safe place when things like that happen. and we're worried that we'll no longer be perceived as such a safe place for tourists to come, because, you know, our economy is based mainly on agriculture, but then very close behind it is tourism. And so anything like this that would keep people from visiting New Zealand is worrying. But also just the fact that she was just this beautiful young girl from Essex who was doing a year backpacking around the world, having a good time, and was in a really safe part of the country, Auckland, and she's just gone missing and disappeared without a trace. So not only is it fascinating that she's disappeared without a trace, but just it's a really sad story. And so, yeah, there's a massive campaign in New Zealand on all the radio stations and TV stations and newspapers to try and get any information that people have got for her.
Okay, well, moving along to China, and this is being reported by the ABC out of Australia and I guess across Asia as well. A story nonetheless bizarre for being weirdly unsurprising, which is that the Chinese scientist who last week was claiming that he had edited the genes of twin sisters now appears to have vanished.
Why do you think this is unsurprising? I guess it's China.
Yes, exactly. A pattern is emerging of people whom displease or embarrass China sort of disappearing.
This is what happens in China when the government doesn't like what people are doing, they disappear. Same as in Russia and North Korea and places like that. But yeah, Dr. He Zhangkui, he's a renowned Chinese scientist who's got a multi-billion dollar probably company and science labs and things like that. He altered the genetics of these twin girls, I think while they were still in the womb, to prevent them from carrying on the HIV virus that they'd passed on from their father. And he passed it on. He announced what he had done at this big science symposium thing, and it shocked hundreds and hundreds of scientists. Were shocked. The government was shocked. The university was shocked and said, "No, we don't want anything to do with you." The government went and shut down his lab and called it extremely abominable. So now the government's saying it's terrible and all that type of stuff. And he's been missing since last Wednesday. So he's been missing for more than a week. No one's heard from him. A lot of people are suggesting that the Chinese government has kidnapped him.
Yeah, I rather suspect that this story is going to get more coverage in the non-Chinese media than the Chinese media, if people are interested in following this story. And along a similar note, this also from the ABC, and this is a story related to one we were mentioning earlier in our news summary about the arrest of Meng Wanzhou, the chief financial officer of Huawei. But there are other countries which are, I guess, even ahead of Canada and the United States in being concerned about Huawei, and they are specifically Australia and New Zealand.
Yeah, and after the concerns of Australia and New Zealand, so first of all, it was Australia, I think a few years ago, prevented Huawei from rolling out its broadband. Then it followed saying, no, you can't roll out our 5G. Then New Zealand said, we don't want you rolling out our 5G mobile network. And British Telecom has recently also followed suit, saying, okay, we're going to remove some of the Huawei gear that we've got. And then now, of course, the chief financial officer of Huawei, her name is Meng Wanzhou. She's the daughter of the founder, actually. So she's quite high up, and she's been working there for 25 years and probably one of the success stories, I guess, of China tech. She's been detained in Canada on behalf of the United States. So not only is this, I guess, making those tensions between the United States and China, which are already pretty tense, right? Even though there was this pseudo-truce between Xi Jinping and Donald Trump at the G20 summit in South America, it's probably just ramped things up a whole lot more now that they've put someone like this, the golden girl of China tech, detained them and going to be extradited back to the United States. So this is going to absolutely ramp up those tensions between China and the United States.
That one, I suspect, is going to run and run. We should move on, therefore, to something, let's call it a little more niche. I don't really know where to start with. I will read the headline for all the sense I suspect it's going to make to 90%. To 98% of our listeners, which is that Nehe Milner-Scudder has weighed in on Santa Stoush and takes aim at cultural assimilation. Kudos to stuff.co.nz for using the excellent Antipodean word Stoush in a headline. I shall translate. That means fight.
Is it an Antipodean word?
It is. You can't have that to yourselves. Sorry. No. I would be willing to engage in a discussion over who actually invented it. Obviously. obviously I'm going to say Australia, but it is certainly freely used on both sides of the Tasman, and it's an excellent word. Stoush, use it in conversation this week. What on earth is going on here?
So there was a Santa parade, a Christmas parade in Nelson, a little town at the top of the South Island in New Zealand, and the council had appointed someone who didn't really look like the typical Santa that we all know. He was Māori, he didn't have a white beard, he wasn't wearing a red suit, he was wearing a corduroy cloak, which is a cloak made of feathers, and it was red, and he was holding like a big Māori sort of spear type thing, and caused a whole lot of outrage because kids had no idea who this guy was who was sitting up on Santa's sleigh, and it's caused a whole lot of people being like, why do Māori have to claim everything? And it's caused this massive race debate. So you've got commentators all over the show commenting on this. And this particular story in All Black, Nehe Milne-Scudder, one of my favourite All Blacks actually, brilliant All Black, he's waded in saying, oh, for goodness sake, this is, why is everyone up in arms about this? You guys stole all our land and colonised us, and now you're trying to blame us for ruining your Santa parade. Back off. Quite a good argument actually that he makes.
I would classify myself as very firmly in the who cares column. Yep. on this one. As far as I can tell, Mr. Heroini playing the role of Santa, he appears to be having an absolutely excellent time.
He looks great.
He looks actually way cool now that I look at it closely. What possible reaction is there to this other than, well, good for him?
A lot of people are saying, well, why are Māori stealing our Santa? Why does everything have to be Māori-ified in New Zealand? It's created quite a horrible race debate, actually.
Do you want to tell these people the thing about Santa, or shall I?
Well, I mean, you met about St. Nick.
Yeah. Oh, you mean that he's not real.
Ah, oh, well.
I mean, he's...
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Sorry to have ruined your Christmas there.
I know, exactly. He's not real, so exactly.
I mean, honestly. Mm. Anyway.
No, but I think you're right. Who cares?
A non-story of epic proportions. This, however, okay, this isn't funny.
This is hilarious. Come on.
I mean, there's a woman in hospital, Lloyd. But it is hard not to be amused by the headline. And I quote from Australia's very sober and serious state national broadcaster, vicious blood-spitting alpaca attack had WA, that's Western Australia, women fearing for their lives. I don't know, Australia, I assume we're right for vicious blood-spitting animals. Why are we importing alpacas? What is going on there?
Let me just explain what the story is, right? This lady called Karen, she bought this alpaca from a workmate. She brought it home and she called it Harry.
Was that what it was angry about?
Yeah, possibly. On day one, it attacked her. She just thought that because it was he looked so beautiful, we thought that him spitting at us was just a part of him showing his love for us. But she was there. It bit her on the back. It bit her on the arm. She fell over. Her partner, who was out there having a bottle of VB, was having a beer. For those who don't know what a VB is, and went up and bottled this alpaca. And then that sort of stopped it. Then 10 days later, Karen's mother, 78-year-old Pat, was over there. They were in the garden picking some vegetables, and Harry jumped the fence, reared up at them, pounced on them, and attacked them. And they bit her on her arms, on her neck, they trampled on her, and then they spent the next hour and a half cornered against the house.
A cautionary tale. Lloyd Burr, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Daily. You're listening to The Monocle Daily with me, Andrew Muller, and it is last thing on Friday night, which means only one thing. Well, it means that only one thing in the weeks that he's here, but this week is one of those. It is Fernando Augusto Pacheco with his global countdown. Fernando, welcome back to the programme.
It's a very special one, Andrew. I say this every week.
You say that every week and you haven't been right yet.
No, but this one is the top 5 singles in the US in the whole year. The official list has been published.
And that's good.
That's quite good. Actually, some of the songs are good. I suspect that you might enjoy number 3, actually.
Well, I'll be the judge of that. And of course, we can't start with number 3. We have to do this properly in ascending order. So at number 5, and I reiterate to our Agog listeners that these are the best-selling singles or most listened to or most streamed or however the hell they mention, measure these things these days, singles in the United States this year. And at number 5 is...
I feel very conflicted about that one because I hate his facial tattoos and I... Maybe I have some problems with the singer, but the beat is infectious. Let's hear it. It's Post Malone and 21 Savage with Rockstar. I've been popping pills, man. I feel just like a rock star. All my
my brothers got that gas and they always be smoking like a rock star. When we call up on the hoop, yeah, show up, man, them the shot toss. When my homies pull up on your block, they make that thing go gratatata. I've been in the hills, f***ing superstars, feeling like a pop star.
Is there something wrong with that? It keeps cutting out.
I think we are playing the censored version here.
Oh, I see.
Yes, because...
Is there profane language in the original?
So much profane language. And even the video is kind of profane as well, quite violent at times. And as I said, the facial tattoos, that's profane in a way.
He is setting a poor example for the kids, isn't he?
He is setting, but he's doing very well. And I mean, and of course, they also released the best, the top albums chart. And Post Malone is number three on that chart.
Wasn't
as well.
He in a plane crash or something? Or am I misremembering that?
I don't recall.
I mean, there was a thing with a plane. I could be making this up. There might have been nothing to do with a plane and it could have happened to somebody else entirely.
All I know, he's still alive.
Okay, well. Excellent. So he's at number five, and at number four, doing even better than Post Malone is.
I love number four, Good Old Pop. It's Camila Cabello and Young Thug with Havana. Havana, ooh, nah, nah. Hey. Half of my heart is in Havana, ooh, nah, nah. Hey. Hey. He took me back to East Atlanta, nah, nah, nah. All of my heart is in Havana. Hey. There's something about his manners. Uh-huh. Havana. He didn't walk up with that, how you doing? When he came in, he said there's a lot of girls I can do it, but I can't with that. No,
I mean, yeah, whatever, but I do want to make it clear that it has just been confirmed by Martha in the production booth that I was right about Post Malone and the whole plane thing.
Actually, next time we should invert, you should do the Global Countdown and I interview you about it.
It would be a much shorter segment. But anyway, that was number four, and that was?
Camila Cabello, and she used to be a member of Fifth Harmony, which was a fairly successful girl group. And when she left the group, everybody was saying, oh, Camila, you know, she was not going to be successful, you know, she just
and
disappeared.
And now look at her.
She's more popular than all the members of the group there.
And more popular than Post Malone.
Absolutely.
With whom there was a thing with a plane.
And she's proud.
And I knew that.
And she's proud of her Latin roots as well. I think she filmed the video in Havana itself, actually.
Well, good for her. Without further ado, that gets us to number three. And because I remember things that were talked about 3 minutes ago, I remember that you said this was the one I was going to like.
There's a little bit of country in it. That's why I thought you might enjoy it.
Okay, but before we unleash hell, who actually is this?
It's Albanian-American singer Bebe Rexha, and she's performing with Florida George Line, which is a country duo, and this is the song Meant to Be. If it's meant to be, it'll be, it'll be, baby, just let it be. If it's meant to be, it'll be, it'll be, baby, just let it be. So won't you ride with me, ride with me, see where this thing goes. If it's meant to be, it'll be, it'll be, baby, if it's meant to be. I don't mean to be so uptight, but my heart...
I will concede that in there is the faintly discernible strains of a pedal steel guitar, so kudos for that, but it is otherwise terrible.
Are you not proud that they managed number three in a year dominated by R&B and hip-hop? I don't see excitement.
I wish them well with their future endeavors and so forth, but nah.
Well, number two, I think we might agree on that one, Andrew, and what, for the negative.
You're going to hate it as well?
Yes, I mean, but we have to respect. I mean, one point...
No, don't. This is the mistake you keep making. Millions of pop fans can be wrong.
Well, billions, apparently, because this song has 1.6 billion views on YouTube, and it's Ed Sheeran with Perfect. Baby, I'm dancing in the dark with you between my arms, barefoot on the grass, listening to our favorite song. When you said you looked a mess, I whispered underneath my breath, but you heard it, darling, you look perfect.
Ed Sheeran with the misleadingly titled Perfect.
Not for me.
See, things, all jokes aside, even when I don't like music, and you're aware by now that there's quite a lot of it I don't like, I can usually see why somebody else would. Like those first three tracks you've played today, okay, not my thing, but I can see why people would like that. Ed Sheeran, I am genuinely baffled by. I do not understand it. He is so, so monstrously popular, and I cannot, and I've tried, and I cannot fathom what is going on in the heads of people who think, I know, in exclusion to the all the great popular recordings of great popular music ever recorded by great popular recording artists, I'm going to listen right now to Ed goddamn Sheeran.
I think Ed Sheeran is a bit like, do you know those biscuits, the nice biscuits? I mean, they are kind of flavorless, but you do have it with tea, so I guess that's what, you know, that's what Ed Sheeran is.
But my point is, there are other better biscuits.
Yeah, but those are the easier in the supermarket. They're cheap, you know? You don't need to think.
Okay, so...
Sorry, that's a terrible comparison.
It needs work. It does need work. But basically, Ed Sheeran's a biscuit.
It is a biscuit.
I mean, see, the thing is, the thing I don't get about Ed Sheeran is that basically I like a lot of music made by, like, whiny guys with guitars. And therefore, I consider myself something of an expert on the whole whiny guys with guitar genre. And he's not top drawer.
I hope you like number one, though, Andrew. And actually, breaking news, because today the Grammy nominations came out. And
I know, I've been cruelly passed over again.
And he had 7 nominations, just behind Kendrick Lamar with 8. But of course...
So he's at least as good as Milli Vanilli, then.
Exactly.
Amazing. Who is it?
And this song has been nominated for Song of the Year at the Grammys. Let's hear it. God's Plan by Drake. God's plan. I hold back, sometimes I won't. Yeah. I feel good, sometimes I don't, ay, no. I finesse down Western Road, ay, next. Might go down to G-O-D, yeah, wait. I go hard on Southside G, yeah, wait. I make sure that Northside E. And still, bad things. It's a lot of bad things that they wish and they wish. Excellent
beat. What was that person yelling in the background about? What was going on there?
I have no idea. But again, infectious
beats.
Maybe
they've just been told that up next, Ed Sheeran.
Exactly. Better than Ed Sheeran, isn't it?
Well, yeah, but what isn't?
And Scorpio, his album, is also the second best-selling album. Just behind, Taylor Swift was the number one with Reputation. But she didn't have any very strong singles.
She'll be back. She'll recover from this crushing disappointment.
I'm sure, but I liked the mixture, you know, a little bit of hip-hop, country, pop. Interesting. Could be better, but I don't find it that awful.
Well, who can argue with that? On that upbeat note, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you, as always, for joining us. And that is it for today's edition of The Daily. We apologise for not bringing you that highlight from the upcoming edition of The Big Interview featuring Christine and the Queens, but we did overrun what with the breaking news from the United States and so on. You can catch that full chat this Sunday at 9 a.m. You can, of course, download the podcast of that and any of our other programming whenever you like from our website, iTunes, Spotify, and so on. Tonight's edition of The Monocle Daily was produced by Ben Rylan and Daniel Bates. The researchers were Daphne Karnesis and Nick Moniz. Our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. We're back at the same time on Monday, 2200 London. I'm Andrew Muller. Have a great weekend.